It's pretty good numbers for Friday at almost 4 o'clock, and it's beautiful outside and everyone's ready to be out of here and done. I'm sure that after 2 days, you guys are more than ready to be through with this. And so we'll try and keep this as entertaining as possible, as quick as possible, and get you guys out of here so that you can enjoy your weekend. We know we've got a big game coming up here. So I understand most of you are financial planners or life insurance representatives. And so what we'd like to do today is talk about estate planning for retirement benefits. And we're going to kind of take two tracks here. So I'm going to talk about using trusts with regard to our qualified retirement plans, how we can use trusts in those, and the things to watch out for. And Steve's going to talk about some of the non-trust aspects of estate planning for retirement benefits. So we're going to kind of skip through here some of this. This was for a joke here, but for purposes of time, I think we'll skip through that. It dealt with the lawyer being sleazy and the priest and the doctor being good. Surprise, surprise, right? So one of the things I want to talk about with regard to this presentation is some of the benefits of, a typical retirement plan has a lot of protections. A qualified retirement plan has a lot of protections under the law. ERISA provides a lot of protection. One of the new things, though, that came out recently was this case, Clark versus Raymaker, which basically said that an inherited IRA was not going to receive the same protection as a beneficiary, a participant, or a participant surviving spouse's IRA. And so that's one of the, the old, you used to be able to count on having that protection through the plan itself, but that's no longer the case for these retirement plans that have been inherited. Never name your trust as the beneficiary of your 401k. You guys have probably heard that before. There's a couple of reasons for that. The first is going to be taxes. Trusts are taxed differently than individuals. You start paying taxes a lot quicker with a trust, and the rates can be worse. So the tax situation is not good. Required minimum distributions, which we're going to talk about quite a bit here. Trust accounting is also more difficult. And it's just in general much more complicated if you name your retirement plan or if you name your trust as a beneficiary of your retirement plan. Now, when we talk about required minimum distributions, these are the distributions that are required when you reach age 70 and a half. Your first payment has to come by April 1st of the year after the year that you turn 70 and a half. The idea here is that Uncle Sam wants to get all of its tax on the deferred amounts that you've been saving in your 401k. And so he wants to make sure that he gets those, not before you die, he wants to get almost all of it before you die. And so the idea is that we're going to look at your account balance, we're going to guess how long you're going to live, and we're going to divide those two numbers to figure out what you're going to be required to distribute from your plan each year. And obviously, as that comes out, it gets taxed, and then Uncle Sam gets his piece. So he wants to get as much of that as possible without bringing you to zero. And we'll talk about how we do that. But obviously, when we talk about required minimum distributions, the goal is to keep our assets, the financial means we have within the plan, we want to keep them in there for as long as possible because we are investing Uncle Sam's money. And so if that's the goal, we've got to take some special precautions when we use trust. But the RMD rules have both a lifetime distribution rule, and that's for the participant himself, and then also we have the death rules, the post-death rules, which are for the beneficiaries of those plans, so surviving spouse or children in most cases. Obviously, you can take more than the minimum required minimum distribution, but it doesn't count towards subsequent years. So once we start taking those, we're going to take the amount that we have to take. If we don't take it, we're going to get penalized. There's going to be a 50% penalty on the distribution that we fail to take. Like I said, the RMD is calculated based on some mortality tables that we're going to look at. That's the 50% penalty there. So once the retirement plan owner dies, we have to begin taking those distributions. And the first problem with that is going to be if the person named as a beneficiary is not an individual. Now, if we have an individual, we can take their life expectancy and make the payout based on that individual's life expectancy. If, however, we have a non-entity, we run into some of the problems. But if we do have that individual and we can step them into the place of the participant, and they can begin taking distributions based on their life expectancy, we can get that stretch, as they call it. And you guys have probably heard that term, you know, trying to stretch that out. And the idea there is that instead of distributing the remaining benefits based on the age of the participant, we're going to be doing it based on the age of the beneficiary there. So you see here that these required minimum distribution rules are almost entirely a creature of regulations. The statute is very unhelpful and doesn't really have any of the meat of this. So it's all in those regulations, 1.401A9-1. Now, you'll see here, middle paragraph, in order to calculate your RMD, the IRS has put together mortality tables. So you can go there if you want to find out when you're going to die. Publication, I think it's 590, it's got these tables in there, so you can look it up and see when you're going to pass away. But so the idea is we go to these uniform lifetime tables, we look at our age, and we determine how many years we've got left. And Uncle Sam provides us with that, and then we divide that by our balance to get our required minimum distribution. Now, the tables that the IRS uses for a uniform lifetime table are going to be my mortality plus that of someone who is 10 years younger than me. And the reason they do that is because they don't want it to run out entirely, but they want you to get as close to zero before you die as possible. So they add on that second life that's 10 years younger than you. So hypothetically, you don't outlive it. Now, if you guys can get up to past 115, you could get past this. So a little tax planning technique there is to live a really long time. The other technique you can see here, this is the IRS's form for calculating your RMD. Not too fun there, but so this is the uniform lifetime table. This is table 3, and you can see if you're age 70, you've got 27.4 years left. So that's the good news. And this is based on you plus the person that's 10 years younger than you. Now, one of the other things I wanted to highlight here, this is table 2, and this table is for a participant who is married to somebody who is more than 10 years younger than them. Now, this is an important tax planning technique, so pay close attention to this. If you'll look, let's go down to age 65 on the left-hand column here and scroll over to 21, and you'll see we've got 62.2 years that we can stretch out that IRA. So if you are age 65 and can marry a 21-year-old, you're going to be able to really stretch out your payments and defer that tax for a long time. So that's an important thing to keep in mind if you get to be there. Right. Exactly right. So you can really stretch it out by marrying somebody younger than you. So it's, you know, it's no longer creepy. It's for tax purposes. This table here is the single life expectancy. This is for use of the beneficiary. So if I inherit, my dad passes away, I get his IRA, this is what I'm going to look at. This is not my particular table, but if I were 27, I would have 56 years. I would take my dad's balance and that's divide it, and that's what I would be required to distribute. So that's some of the main meat of the required minimum distribution rules. The problem with a trust is if I name my trust as the beneficiary of my IRA, I pass away, and now those funds are going to go to my trust. If my trust is not set up in the right way, it's going to cause major problems, and I'm going to have to distribute the entire balance of that fund within 5 years. That's a bad result. And so if that trust is not what we call a see-through trust, that's going to be the treatment. And so oftentimes people will go through and they'll go see their estate planning attorney, they'll get a great trust set up, but the anticipation of receiving an IRA or a 401k wasn't there, and the trust isn't set up for that, or maybe the attorney didn't understand that it needed to be set up for that, and all of a sudden, you know, mom or dad dies, and we've got this bad result of having to distribute everything within 5 years. So in order to qualify as a see-through trust, we have to do a couple of different things here, and we're going to talk about those.
You've got a question.
That's more a comment. You're proposing or hypothesizing that really a stretch IRA is appropriate in all circumstances. When I can list off the top of my head more circumstances than I can count on one hand when you really don't want to do it, including the fact doing a stretch RA where you have kids that are have disabilities, and so they would, by having them get on.
Do you guys want them to go on?
My point being is that you're saying it's really bad, and I'm saying there's many times where paying the tax is not a bad thing. Stretching over the 5 years of paying the tax and moving on is not a bad thing. It can be very helpful for the family.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is if you're intending to transfer your IRA or qualified plan to a trust, expecting it to get that stretch, and it doesn't, that's a bad thing. But we'll skip past the slide that covers those things that you just covered for us. So to the surviving spouse outright, when we're looking at transferring between a trust for the benefit of our spouse or transferring to our spouse outright, it's always going to be better if we pass it to the spouse outright in most cases, because the spouse as the beneficiary of a qualified retirement plan has more rights with regard to that plan than a typical survivor beneficiary. So they can roll that over into their own plan, which allows them to start over essentially and not have to take any distributions until they reach age 70 and a half. It also allows them to transfer to a new subsequent beneficiary who can then take their life expectancy. So if it were the reverse, let's say we name the trust as the beneficiary, spouse is a beneficiary of that trust, and it pays to her for her lifetime, and we establish the deferral percentage based on wife's lifetime. If she then passes away and it goes to the kids, we don't get to start over with the kids' ages. We have to stick with mom. If we've named mom first, though, and mom passes passes the retirement plan to the kids in trust, we can then take the kids' lifetimes and do it that way. So it makes it a little bit more beneficial as far as stretching that out if we name the spouse outright. Now, there are circumstances when that might not be the best, but we won't get into those at this time. Now, this was some of the stuff that was just covered, so we'll skip past that. But there are occasions when we don't want to necessarily name the trust as the beneficiary. If it's all going to charity, it doesn't matter. There's lots of things like that, and we kind of covered that. So five requirements for the trust to be qualified as a see-through trust. Now, when we look at these requirements, the first thing you're going to notice is that all of those look really simple. And they look like almost every trust would fulfill those. So the first one really is as simple as it looks. The trust must be valid under state law. The IRS has never, to my knowledge, invalidated a see-through trust saying that it was not valid under state law. That's a pretty simple one. The second one, the trust is irrevocable or will by its terms become irrevocable upon the death of the participant. The next one, the beneficiaries must be identifiable from the trust instrument. The documentation must be provided to the plan administrator, and all trust beneficiaries must be individuals. For you guys, probably the most applicable one here is going to be number four. Oftentimes, you guys are involved with the family. After there's a death, there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of moving pieces, and making sure that documentation is provided to the plan administrator is huge. And there's a deadline on that we're going to talk about that we want to make sure that you guys are keeping your clients informed of. So. And then the last one is all trust beneficiaries must be individuals.
Quick question for you on that one.
Yeah.
On that last point there, if you have a child that's terminally ill, or let's say is pre-deceased and left a living trust, would a living trust that would cut that out? Does that create another problem that you can't work around on that?
If the sick child has died and has left a trust?
Yes. You can't leave it in a living trust then for the 5-year plan.
You could leave it to the living trust. Who's the beneficiaries of the trust? Yeah, you can leave the benefits to that. If you left it directly to the trust that child had established, you could get the payout based on the life expectancy of the grandchildren.
Okay, but I'm talking about just see-through trust status going for the 5-year payout.
If we have see-through trust status, we don't have to do the 5-year payout. We get to do the life expectancy payout.
Okay.
So the big thing here also, the trustee is the one who has to comply with the RMD rules. So for you guys, that's a benefit. You guys can tell you know, the trustee what you think might be right or wrong. And luckily, they don't have to rely on you. They're going to be the ones responsible for making sure that that's paid. Otherwise, the penalty comes from them. So that's why we tell them they should consider getting a legal opinion. Have that trust reviewed is an important part of this. If the trustee can get into an attorney who understands this stuff and look at that trust and make sure that it's right before they gamble and risk that penalty, that's a good way to go. So we talked about being valid under state law. That one's really simple. We'll skip past it in the interest of time here. This one's also straightforward. We're going to skip past that. Beneficiaries must be identifiable. This is where it starts to get a little bit tricky, and we're going to get more into that, but I want to skip to four here just for a minute. Well, actually, let's start here. So let's go through an example. Eric leaves his IRA in equal shares to three separate trusts, one for each of his daughters, Mercedes, London, and Kennedy. The trusts each pay income to daughters for life, and after their deaths, it pays the income to their widower, if any, for his life. The remainder goes to grandchildren. This will not qualify as a see-through trust. The problem is we cannot identify under this trust who the oldest beneficiary is going to be. So when we look at the see-through trust, what we're going to do is we're going to see through it to the beneficiaries that are inside, and we're going to look to the oldest beneficiary of that trust, and we're going to take their life expectancy. But if in a trust like this, we can't see who those people are going to be because my children could, after my death, marry somebody that's older than them, we don't know who that oldest person is going to be. So this trust fails for that reason. Now, the identifiable test is applied first at the date of death. So right when a participant dies, we're going to look at that and see, okay, can we identify who all the beneficiaries of this trust are? And we're also going to be given a period of time, depending on when the participant died, but we're going to have until September 30th or October 31st? Of the year after the year that the participant dies in order to make a few changes. So for example, if we have a problem with, let's say it's a charity that's involved with this thing and not an individual, and we want this to be a see-through trust, but this charity presents that problem, we can pay out the charity if we can make the determination of what the charity is supposed to get. If we pay them out before that subsequent date, we can remove them and not blow this whole thing up. So, you know, we can go back before that beneficiary finalization date, which is September 30th, and make that change before that happens. We can also put into place a disclaimer, things like that. If there's, you know, let's say we've got a surviving spouse who is going to be the age that we're going to use for this see-through trust, but mom doesn't need these interests that are in the trust, so mom can disclaim that, and then we can drop down to the kids and use their lives and get that longer period. So the documentation deadline, October 31st of the year after the year of the participant's death. So if we have a death on December 31st, you know, you've got a short amount of time. If you have a death, you know, on January 1st, you've got a long time. So it's a little bit tricky. Normally with an estate tax return, it's very simple. It's 9 months, right? We've got to file that estate tax return in 9 months. In this case, it really depends on when the beneficiary or the participant dies. So we've got to be really careful about this one. If you miss it, there is no correction that the IRS has put out there for remedying this defect. It's basically a fatal flaw in this case. So we want to be very careful about supplying them with the documentation. So what do we have to give them? We can either put together a list ourselves, go through the trust and figure out who all the beneficiaries are, what they're supposed to get, all of that stuff, and supply that to the plan administrator. That's one way to go if we don't want to give them the trust. The other option is to give them a copy of the document. Now, if you can, you give them a copy of the document, you let them figure it out and see if it works. You know, the trusts these days are, you know, lengthy, they're complicated, and you may not want to be the one who's searching through trying to figure out who the beneficiaries are, and if you supply that trust, the entire trust, you don't have to go through that trouble. So if the first four rules are met, then the trust beneficiaries will be treated as the participant had named them, as if the participant had named them directly as beneficiaries. Then we have to determine if all of the people are individuals. So all trust beneficiaries have to be individuals in order to be a see-through trust. And one of the problems that we have here is that oftentimes a trust will say that the assets of the trust should be used to pay estate expenses. If that's the case, we have a problem. And the IRS hasn't gone here yet, but we have the potential for them to say that the estate is a beneficiary of this trust, which blows up the see-through status. So the best practice is to have within the trust a provision that states that the retirement plan assets cannot be used for the payment of estate expenses. Other assets have to be used for that purpose. Let's dive into this a little bit more here. So which trust beneficiaries count? Oftentimes when we get these trusts, we have a living trust that as soon as the settlor dies, it divides up a bunch of different ways. And then we've got to look at where the money is going and who to count. So there's a three-step process for making this determination. First, we're going to disregard any beneficiary who predeceased the participant. Next, we're going to determine whether certain beneficiaries may be disregarded because even though they are beneficiaries of the trust, they will not share in the retirement benefits that are payable to that trust. And third, determine whether any beneficiaries who definitely will or potentially could share in the retirement benefits can be disregarded for some other reason, such as distribution, we pay them out, disclaimer, they say I don't want any part of this inheritance, or their benefits prior to the beneficiary finalization date, that's that September 30th of the year following the year of death, or because they are mere potential successors to other beneficiaries. So this is where it starts to get really muddy. So let's take a typical trust that splits up a living trust that then becomes a marital share and a family share. If the benefits are required to be paid to that marital trust and we have somebody else that's in that family trust, we can go ahead and disregard those people in that family trust. Yeah, exactly. So first issue here, if benefits are payable to the funding trust but allocated to a particular share of the trust. So let's look at an example here. Trust that divides assets between marital and credit shelter trust and all benefits are allocated to the marital trust. So the regulations tell us that in this case, we don't have to look at all the beneficiaries of the funding trust if the benefits are allocated only to certain beneficiaries or subtrusts because they are the only beneficiaries with respect to the trust interest in the benefits. So that was that example there. If all of those are going to the marital trust, and we can disregard that credit shelter trust. But the IRS has been a little bit wishy-washy on this issue. The next one, the subtrust named directly as beneficiary of the retirement plan assets. So the beneficiary designation leaves death benefit to children, but if a child is under the age of 35, then such child's share shall be paid into trustee of the separate trust to be established for such beneficiary under article whatever. So in this case, the beneficiary designation form names a particular subtrust rather than funding the main trust. In this case, only that subtrust is going to be counted. So if we're being really careful about trying to get see-through trust status and we know that we're establishing these subtrusts within the trust where we want the retirement plan assets to go, the best practice is going to be naming within the beneficiary designation that subtrust and not the trust as a whole. And we can eliminate some of that uncertainty. What if the trustee has discretion in allocating benefits? So the pre-residuary beneficiaries are charities, and the residue is the settlor's children, and trustee has discretion to satisfy pre-residuary bequests from any assets and distributes to the charities from other non-retirement benefit assets. Now, this situation seems like it would disqualify the trust because retirement plan assets are payable to a trust with non-individual beneficiaries. However, the IRS has blessed the situation in a couple of instances, and because the pre-residuary beneficiaries didn't have a right to demand payment from the retirement benefits, and there were other assets, they didn't deem that to be a disqualifying beneficiary. Next issue here, the trust mandates allocation, not under a formula, of retirement benefits to certain subtrusts. This type of allocation should work and shouldn't present a problem. The problem with all of the see-through trust law is that the IRS has, most of the stuff is in PLRs, which you cannot rely on as authority before the IRS. And so we've got a lot of PLRs that go in different directions, but we sort of look at these trends and see what they've done most recently and what they've done more than once. And it looks like, you know, in certain circumstances it works, in certain circumstances it doesn't. But we've got to be really careful about it and looking at it. So this next issue, the trust mandates allocation pursuant to a formula. Can the beneficiaries of the other subtrusts be disregarded? So example here is the trust creates a marital and credit shelter trust or other subtrust through a formula and specifies that retirement plan assets, to the extent possible, are allocated to a particular subtrust and should only be used to fund other subtrusts if there are no other assets. We've got conflicting PLRs on this, but most recently the IRS has suggested they will ignore the other beneficiaries. But again, it's a PLR that we can't rely on. So I hope that those first few issues illustrate that it's not as clear-cut as simply saying, oh, can we identify the beneficiaries and we're ready to go. It is pretty difficult when we get into the weeds here. So if we have a retirement plan and we name our three children as the beneficiaries of that retirement plan, for ADP purposes, for determining that divisor, we can take each of my kids separately and treat those as three separate beneficiaries and have three separate ADPs. That's not three separate divisors. That's not our problem. If, however, we name a trust that benefits these three kids and creates three subtrusts for those kids, not as clear. This is something that people have been fighting with the IRS about, and I think that it's going to become more clear in the future. But right now, again, the best practice is to name those three kids subtrusts individually to make sure. This isn't going to be a huge deal if your kids are close in age. The divisor is not going to change that much, but if we have younger adopted kids or other things, it might become more of an issue. So, on time here. So, mere potential successors. To test trust beneficiaries for mere potential successor status, we divide trusts into two categories, conduit trusts and accumulation trusts. Now, a conduit trust is going to be any trust that requires the distribution of all income that comes from, at least from those retirement plan assets, to the beneficiaries. If it doesn't require the distribution of all of the income that comes from that plan, it's not going to be a conduit trust. If it is a conduit trust, however, we can rely on that as a see-through trust. If it meets the other requirements and it's a conduit, we're going to be safe. We don't have to look. Even if there's a charity down the line somewhere in this trust, we're okay as long as all the income has to be paid to that conduit beneficiary. If it's an accumulation trust, then the test goes on and becomes a little bit more difficult. But so the downside to structuring this as a conduit trust is going to be that we're required to distribute the assets. Now, one of the big reasons we might have put the assets into trust in the first place is because we didn't want to have an automatic distribution of those interests to the beneficiaries. Maybe they're a spendthrift, maybe there are substance abuse issues, whatever it might be. That might not be the best thing if we're required to give them that RMD and anything else that comes out of that retirement plan. So we want to watch carefully on that. We can go with the conduit trust status, we can structure it that way, but we lose the ability to withhold those distributions for different things. An accumulation trust is going to be any trust that's not a conduit trust. So if it doesn't require the distributions, then it's going to be an accumulation trust. And when we get to the accumulation trust, some or all the potential remainder beneficiaries do count for RMD purposes. We won't read the regs to you here. So let's see here. Skip ahead, we're running out of time. So an accumulation trust can be tested by counting all successive beneficiaries down the chain of potential beneficiaries who or which will be entitled to receive trust property immediately and outright upon the death of the prior beneficiaries. So what we're going to do here is an exercise of killing everyone off until we get to the person that we immediately and outright distribute these assets to. Once we've done that, we can determine whether or not those are going to be all the individuals that we have to count. Now, if that last person dies and then we have to give it to a charity, that's when we're going to run into a problem. So we go through this exercise of killing these people off in order to determine whether we have a see-through trust or not. So the bottom line here is that for your guys' purposes, the big thing for you is going to be looking at all of these trusts that you get. If anybody comes to you and says, hey, look, I want to name my retirement plan or my trust as the beneficiary of my retirement plan, we need to stop. We need to look at that trust. We need to test it and see if it is a see-through trust. So let's kill off the beneficiary that day and run through and see if we have potential problem beneficiaries that are non-individuals, things like that, and see if it makes sense to have that retirement plan named as a beneficiary and talk with the client about whether or not they want to do that, if it makes more sense to name the children outright. You know, naming a trust can have benefits. We can provide some more asset protection by naming the trust. We can control some of the distributions. There's a lot of benefits, but there's also a lot of setbacks. And so it really makes sense to talk through the client with some of those issues and just make a determination as to whether or not it makes more sense to name the kids outright as beneficiaries or if they want to keep that in the trust. So I'll turn the time over to Steve now.
All right. Thanks, Eric. So, you know, it's interesting. We as attorneys, we have a tendency to like our creativity and our ability to think we can draft a trust to benefit our clients' needs. And, you know, it's interesting talking about the conduit trust and the stretch IRAs. Philosophically, I've always been kind of in favor of that because it makes sense to me, because if a client has a substantial amount of assets which are in an IRA and they want that to go to their children, but they don't want to, and they're as the client is philosophically opposed to having tax applied to their IRA, they may want that to be stretched as much as possible. And I've had a number of clients where that's a priority. And so for them, trying to have the stretch IRA makes a lot of sense. But this gentleman over here who raised the comment about, and one of the problems of that, though, is you have issues of being able to use that trust as you might otherwise want to use it, such as what if you do have a special needs beneficiary and you need to have the provisions of the trust not have distributions because it might end up causing that beneficiary to lose their government benefits, or other things such as asset protection, which Eric talked about a little bit. So I think it's interesting because as the attorney, it's easy for me to say to the client, well, if you've got an IRA and it has substantial assets and you want those assets to go to your children and you want as little of this tax as possible, hey, the stretch IRA is a great way to go. The problem, however, isn't in the drafting as the drafting attorney, because I'm confident in my ability to prepare an estate plan which will accomplish what I foresee is the intention of the client. The problem is in the administration. As the drafting attorney, I have often very little control in my ability to ensure that the trustee, the financial advisor, other people who will be involved down the road, actually in many cases it's even just the surviving spouse, will know how to receive that. I mean, they may be a beneficiary of the trust, it may be all drafted correctly, and despite that good planning and complete organization on behalf of the client and the intended beneficiaries, without that synergy with the advisor and the attorney, there may be some problems which result in some of these important details which Eric suggested get lost. So with that in mind, sometimes we think about, well, because of the complexity of naming the trust as the beneficiary, in some circumstances it may make sense, despite the fact that I philosophically like the idea of using the trust as beneficiary, circumstances may arise which make it not in the best interest. One specific issue to be very well aware of, and I think I get into this more in my presentation, but just to put this out there to you at the outset, it's very common, and it has been very common, for people to name a marital trust as the beneficiary of an IRA. The intention being that, and a marital trust is often also referred to as the Q-tip trust, the Qualified Terminable Interest Property Trust, and that trust specifically exists and has existed for many years when the estate tax exemption has been low, so that whatever goes into the marital trust will be part of the estate of the surviving spouse. And usually the idea is you want to have those assets used up so there will be as little estate tax applicable to the surviving spouse's estate as possible. So you want to have as much used out of that trust as possible. Well, one of the problems with having the marital trust named as the beneficiary is if the trust isn't drafted right, there are two problems which occur often. Again, the intention of the marital trust is to ensure that you get the marital deduction on the decedent spouse's estate. You know, the person dies, and if they had an estate of $10 million right now, you'd want to make sure that that the person's current estate tax exemption is being used up, being applied. And so you have that portion go over to an exemption trust or a credit shielding trust, and then the portion which isn't part of the decedent spouse's estate will go to the marital trust, and you get the unlimited marital deduction. Well, if we name the marital trust as the beneficiary for the IRA with the anticipation or the intent that the marital trust will provide for unlimited exemption, if the trust isn't drafted right, you can actually lose the marital deduction. So for a lot of people right now, they have the ability to use resources online, and maybe attorneys who may not be very well versed in sophisticated estate plan drafting, they might inadvertently draft a trust which doesn't provide properly for the IRA to be distributed properly, and you lose the marital deduction. And I've actually seen this happen where the people lose the marital deduction. Now, it's actually kind of rare because it's unusual for the IRS to become aware of that unless they audit a 706 estate tax return. But it does happen sometimes. Nowadays, unfortunately, from the tax planner's perspective, it's unfortunate that the estate tax exemption is so high because most people don't have the exposure to estate tax, with the exemption now being 5.4 plus million, so 10.8 as a couple. You know, I think the figure is 1% of people who have potential for estate tax exposure. So the need to make sure that that planning is in place isn't as acute as it used to be. But still, there are clients who have that situation. And so it's important to make sure the trust is drafted properly. The other issue which can come up is if you do name the marital trust as the beneficiary for the IRA, there's an interesting law which applies. It's called the Uniform Principal and Income Act. And that act designates that if the trust is not clear as to whether the RMD is considered to be income or principal, the RMD will be considered 90% to be principal. Well, so what? If all that's going to the surviving spouse, who cares? Because the intention probably is for the surviving spouse to receive the RMD. And especially because the RMD is based upon that surviving spouse life expectancy. Eric talked about how that's derived. Well, the problem is if the trust says distribute all the income from the marital trust to the surviving spouse, not a problem. But if there's ambiguity as to how the principal or whether principal is to be distributed from the marital trust to the surviving spouse, and if all of the RMD is distributed to the surviving spouse, we have a problem. That problem being, was that RMD, which all of it was transferred to the surviving spouse, and under the Uniform Principal and Income Act says that it's 90% principal, was that distribution authorized? And the problem may be that it's not, because if the trust doesn't provide for distribution of principal, and all the RMD goes to the surviving spouse, 90% of that distribution may have been required to come into the trust as an accumulation trust to be used for the benefit of the long-term beneficiaries. Now, it's kind of an interesting thing because regardless of who gets it, ultimately you're going to have a tax offset. As Eric indicated, you know, in a trust, the rates graduate quicker. The highest tax rate's the same, 39.6%, but it graduates at, I think the figure is $14,000 of income is when the highest tax rate applies for a trust. So if it does go into the trust, it's going to be taxed at the higher rate much quicker than if it goes to the surviving spouse. Anyhow, that's an issue just for you as advisors and insurance individuals to be aware of, that if someone says, hey, I'm going to name my trust as the beneficiary, there may be some good reasons to do that, but let's make sure the trust is drafted right, and let's make sure whether the intention is for all of the RMD to go to the surviving spouse, or if the intention is for part of the RMD to go to the surviving spouse and part to be accumulated. In my experience, most people, I think, intend for all the RMD to go to the surviving spouse. But if it's ambiguous, you may have a problem which can cause problems. Okay, so the other thing I want to touch on, which is if the intention is not to use a trust, and there are many reasons why you may not want to use a trust. Again, some people are just philosophically opposed to using trust because of the complexity. I understand that. They can be challenging because of the nature of how involved the various advisors should be involved to make sure it's run correctly. If that's the case, then maybe not using a trust is a good idea. So one of the things about these assets, IRAs, 401ks, qualified retirement accounts, they are non-probate assets. And so the thing I've put down there, which is interesting, they pass by contract, not by will. And it's interesting. I think it's very important that the advisors all are part of that process of creating the beneficiary designation form. It's probably a very common practice for people to say, okay, I'm going to set up an IRA, and the financial advisor may pass over to the client, here's the beneficiary designation form. Who do you want to be the beneficiary? And the person says, I want my surviving spouse, and they sign and pass it back without much thought of what goes into it. So in my opinion, I think it's a very good practice for both the financial advisor and the attorney to be involved in that process of filling out that beneficiary designation form, even if it is a kind of a boilerplate form, I think it's just good practice. The other issue is sometimes we have loss of stepped up in basis. Now, you're probably all familiar with the stepped up in basis rule of when a person dies, the basis in property steps up. We don't get that benefit. And then the other issue is the rules and rules, which often are complex and a difficult issue to deal with. Again, my philosophy is that a retirement plan is a will substitute. One of the things I can remember back in law school that my estates and trust professor talked about was that there are various will substitutes. Traditionally, people think of the will as the primary estate transfer device, and for many people that's true, but there are various will substitutes. One of them is, of course, a trust. One of them is a beneficiary designation form. Now, I love this picture of Newman. There's a famous episode of Seinfeld where Newman says, "He who controls the mail controls information." And I think that's interesting because he who controls the client's information controls their destiny, so to speak. So it's very important that as the advisors, we are really aware of our clients' needs, their desires, and their intentions. We have to have that information. I would advise you to really make sure that you understand your client's desires and what they want to do with their plan. Beneficiary priority, make sure that we have their designation spelled out. Now, here's a couple things to look at. When considering whether to name a beneficiary, there are a lot of competing interests. Again, it's very common for people to want to name their surviving spouse as the beneficiary and for to receive the distribution. However, the tax rates apply. We as tax attorneys and CPAs, we love to kind of look at figures and how we can maximize tax benefits. If you name a surviving spouse who has other income and has substantial income, the RMD is going to be taxed at a higher rate potentially as compared to if you name a child who has a lower tax rate, they may get a better tax rate, which is a good planning thought. The other problem, though, with a spouse, if you give it all to your spouse, what's the possibility of their spouse? Again, it's interesting. Eric made that interesting example of marrying a younger person for the tax benefit. Well, if I'm 65 and marry a 25-year-old, if I expect to die in 10 years and that person's 35 when I die, the likelihood of them getting remarried is very good. And so that's one reason why either you decide to put it in trust or for having the beneficiary designation form specify either none or a specific portion of the RMD or the IRA only going to the surviving spouse. Disabled beneficiary, again, that's an important issue because we don't want them to lose their government benefits if they're a beneficiary. And charities are great because of the tax benefits. I touched on this briefly, but I just want to emphasize it, going back to my discussion a minute ago about the problem with naming a trust as the IRA beneficiary. Income for tax purposes is not the same as income for trust administration purposes. And that's why this issue, if the IRMD is all distributed, all that RMD is going to be taxable, because what is it? It's all tax-deferred income. You know, the settlor, or the person who established that IRA, they had that put away for a time, and it's been deferred tax, it's deferred compensation, right? It's deferred growth. Well, when it becomes time to distribute, because it's RMD, all that has to be taxable. But that doesn't mean, under the terms of a trust, that it's all income for trust administration purposes. So a complex issue to be aware of. Trust accounting is an issue that can be very complex and a challenge for many practitioners as well as clients, obviously. Here's an issue which I think is interesting. If you name the beneficiary of a younger child or younger beneficiary as the beneficiary of the IRD, the GST weighs concern. GST, the GST tax, you might have a situation where if you give it all to the beneficiary who's a younger beneficiary, you're going to lose the benefit of that. Again, the skip person, you may have heard of that. A skip person is a grandchild or a person in equal generation to a grandchild in relationship to the settlor or the person who established the IRA. Another issue with regard to naming a child or grandchild as the beneficiary outright is lack of control. As an attorney, I love the idea of being able to help a client, you know, draft a trust which really reflects their desire to control assets. And as I tell clients, you can draft a trust as giving everything outright and free of trust to they get nothing unless the trustee thinks they wear the right colored shirt. I mean, you can specify what kind of distribution provisions you want in your trust, and that's really nice, because if you have one child who's a spendthrift, you may not want them to receive a distribution. And I've had plenty of clients who literally have, you know, said, my child gets nothing but income until they're 65 years old. That's when I think they might be reasonably responsible enough to receive a distribution of principal. You know, but that's just the client's discretion. So that control can be a that lack of control can be a real problem. And the custodian issue can be arising. I'm going to jump down because I wanted to just touch on this. An alternative for just naming, you know, a trust as a beneficiary is what's referred to as the individual retirement trust. Have any of you heard of that or dealt with those? They're relatively, I don't want to say new, but I don't know many people who have used them, but they're available. And essentially, they're as I've written, they're a planning option under IRC Section 408, a conduit trust substitute, and takes the form of a legal trust. And there is a trustee involved. It can be beneficial. Control beyond the grave is an opportunity there. Participant can name a successor beneficiary to receive what is left in the account after the first beneficiary's death. Asset protection is available. No legal fee to pay for drafting, which is a negative from my perspective as a drafting attorney because I want people to come to me to draft their trusts, but it's available. The IRA provider trustee can administer the funds directly for the participant's benefit during his or her life, which could be handy in case of disability. So again, that's an opportunity to provide for that protection. The IRT can usually be used as a substitute for leaving IRA benefits to a separate standalone conduit trust under a trusted IRA rather than having an IRA that is held by one institution and payable to another person. The two functions are combined. Okay. These are options which are really, I think, important. You can do distributions of RMD only. RMD and request for principal is needed. Other payout options, compliant with IRA rules, and discretionary distribution standards for trustee, limited or general powers of appointment. Some pitfalls, though. As a drafter of attorney of trust, I think the traditional trust is superior for asset protection. I was mentioned before, I'm an attorney both in Utah and Nevada, and I'm very fond of both Utah and Nevada trusts. The laws in both states are favorable for asset protection purposes, and we recommend them for various purposes. The one problem with the trustee IRA is the trustees are limited. They're financial institutions, and there's not that many that are comfortable taking the potential liability of being a trustee. That's always an issue, though. You know, who wants to be a trustee, especially if it's a large asset? If you've got assets under management, typically your large banks who act as trust companies, they're going to be much more comfortable taking on that liability because they're going to have some assets and expectation of return. But if the assets don't have much to manage, they may be more reluctant. Other issues are administrative fees. And then down at the bottom, trustee IRA cannot accumulate distributions from the plan for future beneficiaries. These are some additional issues which you should be aware of when you're just thinking about how do you want to assist your clients. These are issues just to be aware of. You know, how to reduce taxes. Again, there's competing interests. And for some people, minimization of taxes and stretching out distributions to avoid taxes is the highest priority. For some people, it's control. So those things have to be kind of weighed. How to pay taxes. Applicability of GST taxes. No gifting. Yeah.
What's the GST tax?
The generation skipping transfer tax. Have you heard? Is there a question in the back? Okay, yeah. So GST is the generation skipping transfer tax, which is essentially a second estate tax. You know, if a person dies, their estate tax exemption is $5.4 million for their estate. But if there are transfers made to skip persons, which I mentioned before, is people who are grandchildren or younger than grandchildren or the same generation of grandchildren, and the tax code defines all that, then transfers to them are hit with an additional estate tax. So it's a problem. Okay. I think we're out of time. We're supposed to be at 4:30? Okay. You know, we've covered a lot of information. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer any questions or stick around and answer questions if you'd like. So appreciate you coming. Thanks very much.